नमो भगवते वासुदेवाय नमो भगवते वासुदेवाय ॐ नमो भगवते वासुदेवाय We are reading from Srimad Bhagavatam, Canto 4, Chapter 28, entitled Puranjana Becomes a Woman in His Next Life, and we're reading text 64. Evam saha manaseha hamsaha hamsena pratibodhita svastata svastaha tatvyabhicharana nastam apa punaha smritim evam sa manaso hamso Ansena pratibodhita svastastat vyabhicharena nastam apapunasmatim evam sa manaso hangso ansena pratibodhita Svastastatya picharena Nastam apapunaspritim Evam sa manaso hangso Hangsena pratipoditaha Svastastatya picharena Nastam apapunaspritim
Satsang with Mooji
thus. Saha. He. The individual soul. Manasaha. Living together within the heart. Hamsaha. Like the swan. Hamsena. By the other swan. Pratibodhitaha. Being instructed. Svastaha. Situated in self-realization. Tadvyabhicharana. By being separated from the super soul. Nastam. Which was lost. Apa. Gained. Punaha. Again. Smritin. Real memory. Translation and purport by Srila Prabhupada, Prabhaki. In this way, both swans live together in the heart. When the one swan is instructed by the other, he is situated in his constitutional position. This means he regains his original Krishna consciousness, which was lost because of his material attraction. Purport. Here it is clearly stated, Hangso Hangsena Prabhupotitaha. The individual soul and the super soul are both compared to swans, hamsa, because they are white or uncontaminated. One swan, however, is superior and the instructor of the other. When the inferior swan is separated from the other swan, he is attracted to material enjoyment. This is the cause of his fall down. When he hears the instructions of the other swan, he understands his real position and is again revived to his original consciousness. The Supreme Personality of Godhead, Krishna, comes down, avatar, to deliver his devotees and kill the demons. He also gives his sublime instruction in the form of Bhagavad Gita. The individual soul has to understand his position by the grace of the Lord and the spiritual master, because the text of Bhagavad Gita cannot be understood simply by academic qualification. One has to learn Bhagavad Gita from a realized soul. Tat vidhi pranipatena paripashnena savaya upadek shanti te jnanam jnaninas tattva darshinaha. Just try to learn the truth by approaching a spiritual master, inquire from him submissively and render service unto him. The self-realized soul can impart knowledge unto you because he has seen the truth. Bhagavad Gita 4:34. Thus, one has to select a bona fide spiritual master and become enlightened to his original consciousness. In this way, the individual soul can understand that he is always subordinate to the super soul. As soon as he declines to remain subordinate and tries to become the enjoyer, he begins his material conditioning. When he abandons this spirit of being an individual owner or enjoyer, he becomes situated in his liberated state. The word swastaha means situated in one's original position. It's very significant in this verse. When one gives up his unwanted attitude of superiority, he becomes situated in his original position. The word tadvyabhicharena is also significant, for it indicates that when one is separated from God due to disobedience, his real sense is lost. Again, by the grace of Krishna and Guru, he can be properly situated in his liberated position. These verses are spoken by Srila Narada Muni, and his purpose in speaking them is to revive our consciousness. Although the living entity and the super soul are one in quality, the individual soul has to pursue the instructions of the super soul. That is the state of liberation. Om Janati Miranda Shah Janandana Shlakyan Chakshurum Militandina Sasmaya Sigura Vanchakalpatarubis Chakribasim Duve Vatan Patitanam Pavani Piru Vaishnavi Piru Nama Om Jaya Shri Krishna Chaitanya Prabhu Nityananda Shri Advaita Garadara Shri Vasadi Gaura Bhakti Vrinda Hare Krishna 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 Hare 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 Ramo Hare Ramo 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 Hare Hare So, a verse about swans. Swans representing the super soul and the not so super soul, being us. We also read in the Bhagavad Gita, in chapter 2, verse 22, Prabhupada, he, in the purport, brings out the example of the two birds sitting in the tree from Mundaka and Svetasvara, Svetasvatara Upanishad, where one bird, that's us, are eating the fruits of the tree, and the other bird is simply watching. And the moment that we realize that this other bird, the super soul, is our friend and we can take instructions from him, then we are liberated, or we realize our liberated state. It's interesting that Prabhupada here, he says, as soon as he declines to remain subordinate and tries to become an enjoyer, he begins his material conditioning. When he abandons the spirit of being an individual owner or enjoyer, he becomes situated in his liberated state. It seems paradoxical that in order to be liberated, you have to give up the idea of being in control. This is the error that we make, that we think that we can actually be in control. This is not a fact. We can be either under the control of Krishna or the control of the material energy. This is the choice we have. So, obviously, our liberated state will be to be in control, under the control of Krishna. Material conditioning, what does that actually mean? Well, it's the idea that we can create by our speculation and manipulation some sort of arrangement that will be better than what is already there. If I faithfully manipulate with material energy, I will be able to arrange a situation where I will be happy. And the more I manipulate and speculate, the better things will be. So, from the mindset that, well, there's no real reason for the world to be how it is. I mean, it just happened randomly. So, in that sense, well, whatever I choose to be reality, that can be reality. And if I can manipulate so that everything around me is as I like it, then I will be happy. Only problem is that we're not alone in this world. Other people are there, jivas, in the form of human beings or animals. Nature has sometimes kind of a mind of its own. It's getting quite cold at the moment. This is not something I particularly ordered. So we are constantly reminded that we're actually not in control. However, the modern paradigm, it claims that advancement in sense gratification, that's civilization. So, relentlessly, we push on. And we quickly forget about this, you know, hey, I got a chatter, so what's the cold gonna do? And while we do that with full faith in the material energy, we have recreational sex, we get drunk or high, preferably both. We gamble on anything that is uncertain, and we eat the dead corpses of other living entities because, hey, who's to say it's wrong? What? I mean, and besides, I need the protein because I get up every morning and I walk all the way to the garage where my car is. At work, I walk back and forth from the desk to the coffee machine so many times. And when I get home, I walk all the way from the garage back to the house, and I'm pushing buttons on the remote control all evening. It's a heavy schedule. I need my protein, right? So, this is going on. And yeah. In Denmark, this is where I'm from, When you call someone holy, when you say to something that they're holy, it means that they're arrogant, that they think they're better than other people. It's actually, what is the word, a derogatory word? Yeah. If you tell someone they're holy, this is a bad thing. You can ask anyone on the street in Denmark, religious people, atheists, it doesn't matter, everybody will say the same. So everything is turned upside down. This is the way we recognize ignorance, that everything is turned upside down. Religion is irreligion, and irreligion is religion. If you're holy, you're a bad person. So why is this? Well, it's because of the illusion that we are the controller and the enjoyer. When we say that people who think that themselves as the controller and enjoyers are ignorant, it's not just because we're on one side of the fence and they're on the other side of the fence and we just think they're stupid. It's actually the only possible outcome of atheism, of thinking ourselves as the controller and enjoyer, because atheism means there is no authority, right? I mean, if you believe in God, you believe that God is the ultimate authority. If you don't believe in God, well, who's the authority? I am, of course. I mean, there's only my senses, my perception of the world. I'm the authority. So, whatever happens, I go to myself. Right? I mean, if I have some sort of problem, I figure it out myself. I'm the authority. So, that means I'm closing in on myself. Now, fact is, I'm not God. Jayadvaita Swami said it very nicely yesterday in the class. We don't even know what's going on the other side of this wall, right? So as we close in, we start to ignore what is going on around us. Because we close in, I'm the authority, what's going on here? So what's going on around us, we ignore that. And to ignore, that's the root word of ignorance. I mean, that's where it comes from, that's what it means. It's not like it's not my opinion, that's just what the word means. So, this is going on. It's impossible for an atheist to understand authority, and this means that it's impossible for an atheist to understand the difference between principle and detail. Because the principle, if there is a principle, that means there is an authority that is outside myself. If we have the principle that you cannot cross a red light, this is a principle, it goes for everybody. Problem is that there is the detail, that if you're driving an ambulance and you have someone in the back who's had a stroke, because he's been drinking, smoking, and eating meat all his life, you can run a red light. So that's the detail. So, for the atheist, this doesn't make sense. He's thinking, well, just ran a red light, so then I can run a red light. Why is he can and I can't? So, this means that we become unable to see reality for what it is. Hence, illusion. So anything the materialist doesn't understand, it doesn't exist. How can it? I'm the ultimate authority, so how anything that I don't understand, it just doesn't make sense to anyone. And anyone who thinks it makes sense, they're nonsense. I recently got an email from an atheist, and yeah. Always fun. He was writing to me that now scientists have figured out that if you try to become happy, you actually become miserable. This was a proven fact. Now hold on, wait a minute. It's not actually wrong, because you become happy by making Krishna happy. So in a sense, he's right. That if you just think about your own self and your me and my happiness and all, that's the source of misery. His conclusion, however, was quite interesting, because his conclusion was that it doesn't matter what we do anyway, so we might as well get drunk, get laid, you know, and we're back to the ignorant part. So atheism is an eternal principle, but it takes many forms. There is gradations, and there is the result of atheism is modern. Now, when we say modern, usually we think what is going on right now, but we have to distinguish between modern and contemporary. Because modern, as atheism, it's an eternal principle. There were modern people in the Roman era, there were modern people, I mean, at all times. But contemporary is how it's manifesting right now. So, 100 years ago, I just heard recently that they were actually considering closing down the patent office because, hey, everything that you can invent, it's been invented. You got your steam engine, you got your light bulb, your double-barreled shotgun, so pinnacle, what are you going to do, right? That's what happens when you can't distinguish between modern and contemporary. You think that, hey, we're there, we're the modern, we're at the top of the game. So today we can see that quite a few things have happened since. So this is the difference between modern and contemporary. Applied modernism means contemporary. We have 6 systems of Vedic philosophy that are just, this is just contemporary at that time. It's taking part of the Vedic, the Vedanta, and making it into a whole philosophy. So this is more qualified than what is going on in the West now, but still, it's the principle is the same. You have the Nyaya, which is just logic, make a whole philosophy out of logic. You have atomic theory, which is just basically, well, everything can be broken down into its smallest parts, so we can't be that, so then, I mean, it makes sense, it's just not a complete philosophy. And you have your Shankara, which is the basis of the Mayavad philosophy. You have your yoga, the Eightfold Yoga system. These things are being made into like whole philosophies. And of course the Vedanta is the total absolute truth, which contains all of them, and everything that is not working for them, Vedanta has an answer to. So this is, you could say, when we realize that the materialistic or the concocted philosophies don't work, then there is door number 2, the Vedanta, the Vedic version. The Vedic version is all about authority. Obviously, Krishna is the ultimate authority. And it's about the understanding that there's a difference between matter and spirit, and that spirit is eternal. And so, whatever the right way to do things has always been there. I'm not going to invent the right way to do anything. Krishna has created this. And whenever you get like an appliance or anything, usually you get some kind of manual that explains how things work. And that's it. You know, the Vedas. That's the manual for how things work. And we can see the result. People who follow the Vedas, everything works out very nicely. People are becoming liberated, self-realized, they're happy, and they're not exploiting the world. People who don't. It's simple. So, when we accept that we have to follow authority, then at some point we have to speak about Varnashram. See, there are 2 types of silences. I think there's regular silence, and then there's the silence when you mention Varnashram. So right now down by the Jalangi you have jackals going. Something's happened. They don't know what, but something's up. But actually, Varnashram is not a big deal. It's just there are two things. There are a way to connect with the material energy and a way to connect with the spiritual energy. And Varna is how to deal with the material, and ashram is how to deal with the spiritual. So Varna basically just is occupation. We have to maintain the body somehow. So whatever is easiest or feels most natural, do that. And then the different Varnas you have, Shudra, Vaishya, Kshatriya, and Brahmana, that the rules and regulations for those will just help us to get the least possible amount of trouble from the material energy. Because we have to remember that the material energy is here to remind us that we are fully dependent on Krishna. It's not meant to be nice. That's not what it's here for. It's meant to be troubled. That's what it is. Because we have to realize that it's not going to give us anything. So if we realize this and we follow the rules, then everything goes pretty smoothly. If we don't, it's going to be a bumpy ride, but we can go back to Godhead anyway. It's not like anyone is doomed or anything. It's just going to be a little more uncomfortable. So just pretty simple. And when you marry, try to marry someone with a mindset that's like your own, because it's just easier. You have something to talk about. So, ashram. Now, ashram usually is not to the same extent subject to kind of these frowns. It's usually goes quite easy. Basically, you have two. You have the householder and you have the renunciate. The renunciate comes in three flavors. The sannyasi, they are super qualified. I mean, if we look at our movement, we have 81 sannyasis now. Super qualified devotees. I mean, there's not really any problems with them. They're pretty fixed up, generally. And then you have the vanaprastas. I guess it's difficult to see them sometimes. They're out in the forest living off tree bark or something. So, also, not really any problems with those. And then you have the householders and the brahmacharis. Usually, it's like the grihasthas think that the brahmacharis think that the grihasthas are just in pure maya all the time. Right? And the brahmacharis think that the grihasthas think that they are these weird, socially awkward types all of them. Actually, that might be true, but that's another discussion. But it's not. The point is that the brahmacharis, they have a lot of time and they live very simply. So when we're doing programs, they can read a lot and they can do the puja and they can do these things very nicely. And the grihasthas, they have the facility to make it happen. So Prabhupada, he was using the blind man, lame man example about the West and India, and I think it pretty much also goes here, that we need both in order to actually make something happen. Personally, I think that we are doing quite good here in Mayapur in terms of cooperation between Grihastha and Brahmachari ashrams. Festivals are going on, classes are being given, morning programs and all these things. It's very nice. Maybe we could be a little better at doing it outside festivals or something, but that's always something that you can do. So in this way, that's Varnashram. It's not really, it's not horrible or anything, it's just reality. And if we accept it, then everything works nicely. If we don't accept it, that's when the problem starts, right? Usually, because most of us from the West, we're what's called Varna Chankara, mixed Varnas. So we are all confused about this. We want the respect of the Brahmanas, we want the power and influence of the Kshatriyas, we want the facilities of the Vaishyas, and we want the total absence of responsibility of the Sudras. Doesn't work like that. We can be totally happy and self-realized if we just pick one of them. That's enough. All of them, it's gonna go bad. It's just gonna go bad. So, where were we? Yes, do we follow the Vedic? Do we follow the Vedic injunctions or do we not? There's usually we hear this, well, we don't really follow the Vedas, we just chant Hare Krishna, right? We're Vaishnavas, we're not. It's true and it's also false. As long as we're chanting Hare Krishna, there are no Vedic injunctions. But are we just chanting Hare Krishna? Raise of hands, how many here are doing 3 lakhs a day? Two? One? There may be some, actually, no. Haridas Thakur, he was just chanting Hare Krishna. There are no rules when you're just chanting Hare Krishna. But we chant 2 hours and then bus. Now I can do whatever the hell I want. I think that was Prabhupada's way of saying it. So when we do that, when we're done with our rounds, yes, now let's go. The Vedic injunctions can help us to not forget Krishna. There is the always remember Krishna and never forget him. So always remember Krishna. This is what we call the Bhagavad service and the Pancharatra service. Bhagavad is the direct service, the chanting of the holy names, taking prasad, very important. And the Pancharatra is the deity worship and all the arrangements that go with that. So the Vedic means the never forget Krishna part. When you're not engaged in these direct activities in service of Krishna, just make sure that you do it within the injunctions of the Vedic paradigm, because then you will be disturbed as little as possible. And that means that you will be able to remember Krishna at the time of death. Not all sorts of weird things will come into your mind, because that's actually the only real test is at the time of death. The last thing we think about is that Krishna, or is it something else? When we are about to die, it becomes like musical chairs, where all these false identifications are battling it out, because as our senses shut down and are removed from the sense objects, and our body is malfunctioning, you can say, there is less and less room to uphold these false identifications, these upadis. We can have false identifications that we are a good cook, or have a great set of hair, or, I mean, it can be anything, whatever. I mean, I play Xbox really well, and that's who I am. But the only thing we really are is servant of Krishna. Now, if that's the last thing that's left before we leave, then that's where we go. But if there's something else left, then we will have to realize that we're not that before we can go back. How will we go back to Goloka Vrindavan if we think that we're a great Xbox player? We don't see them there. We see servants of Krishna. However they serve Krishna, that can be in different ways. I don't think there are anybody playing Xbox, but it can be in different ways. You also have, kshatriyas, you have vaishyas and so on in the spiritual world, but that's not the identification, that's just the activity. So if the last thing that goes through our head before we leave is I'm servant of Krishna, then everything works out nicely. Unfortunately, we have a lot of practice in thinking otherwise, so that's why it is not recommended to wait until the last minute. That's why we're doing what we're doing now. And besides that, what we're doing now in terms of Krishna consciousness is the constitutional position, as Prabhupada states also in this purport, it's the constitutional position of the jiva. Means it's not something we actually choose. I don't choose to become servant of Krishna. I am. The question is, do I realize it? And one thing is to know it and sit here and discuss it in Bhagavatam class. The other thing is to realize it. Everybody is servant of Krishna. The guy down on the corner smoking a cigarette, he's serving Krishna. Krishna made rules for how to deal with fire. He's dealing very properly, because if he doesn't, he gets very nervous and it's very unpleasant for him if he doesn't get his cigarette. On a very, very low level, he's actually serving Krishna. He's following the laws. Devotional service? Definitely not. There is a verse in Bhagavad Gita. Let's see if I can remember. Abhiche suturacharo bhajate mam ananyabhag. How is it? Samyak vyavasito visa. Even if one commits the most abominable activity, if he is engaged in devotional service, he should be considered saintly because he's fixed in his determination. So we have to separate what is material and what is spiritual. It says the most abominable action. It's not like forgot to come to Mangala Arati or, you know, didn't do the Achman properly. It's abominable, the most abominable, not slightly abominable, most abominable activity. So Krishna very boldly here states, he can state things very boldly because, I mean, he's the absolute truth. So that if you're fixed in devotional service, if you're doing your activities with devotion material, it doesn't matter. You could even say matter doesn't matter. The most abominable action Prabhupada describes in the purport, I think, that a devotee can be engaged in some activity which from a social standpoint is considered abominable, right? So from a social standpoint, that means pious, right? This is what the Vedic injunctions are for, explaining piety, because piety is the best vessel for transporting our devotion to Krishna. But if the devotion is not there, it's useless. So if the devotion is there, then whatever vessel you're using, if pious or impious, is actually not important. But naturally, if the devotion is there, you would want to communicate that devotion as good as possible to Krishna. Right? This is a dynamic relationship. Krishna is a person. I'm a person. All of you are persons. So we have a dynamic relationship. So you would want him to know that you love him, and therefore you would obviously use the pious method, because it just works better. but without the devotion, it's useless. That's why we have these smarta brahmanas who miss the point. They think that by their devotional activity, that the activity is the devotion. It's not. That means if I do the Achman properly and I do the puja properly, then Krishna will have to give the result that I want. First of all, it's what's called sakam. That means it's for my own benefit. It's not for Krishna's benefit. It's for my own. And the other thing is, what does this actually mean? It means that my karmic activity dominates bhakti. I'm controlling Krishna by my material activity. I hate to say it, it's atheism. Again, I'm God. I'm controlling Krishna by my karma. No, this is wrong. Only bhakti begets bhakti. You can't force bhakti. You can associate with the devotees, and by that association, bhakti increases. This is the wonderful thing about devotional or spiritual activities, and is that when you give it away, you get more yourself. As opposed to material, when you give it away, you lose it. So this is the change in mindset that we have to develop, develop. And this happens only in the association of the devotees. So this is why it's so important. And obviously, when you're associating with the devotees, there will be Krishna Katha, and this will increase the chances that in the end we will remember Krishna and we will go back home, back to Godhead. So Krishna is not impressed by our material activity. There's nothing we can do that will make Krishna go. You know, everything he created it, he maintains it. With a spark of his splendor, he maintains the whole universe. All the universes, actually. This is just a small one. Brahma has four heads here. There are universes where he has thousands of heads. And he's not impressed by that. That's just business, you know. I mean, that's just maintaining. What he's impressed by is devotion. So this is something that we should always remember, that it must never become mechanical. We get to Mangala Arati because we're supposed to. That's okay, because it's getting cold and all these things, it's early. But when we're there, we should always remember that we're seeing God. Imagine if a Christian person realized that he or she could actually go see God. They would be pretty wild and crazy. We should never take this for granted. The deity is God. And if the curtain opens a little late at Mangala Arati, it can be the best Mangala Arati in years because the devotion is there. It's not about the mechanics of it. If we can separate these things, then we can identify properly as the servant of Krishna. There are these two terms, naimittic dharma and nitya dharma. Naimittic means temporary or circumstantial, and nitya means eternal. It's a synonymous to sanatan dharma. So the problem is for us that we have a tendency to identify with the naimittic dharma. Right now, I'm doing a Vaishya activity, or I'm doing a Kshatriya activity, or I'm whatever we're doing, driving to the temple, or we have a tendency to identify with this, with the form, with the mechanic, where we should be identifying with the Nitya Dharma aspect, the eternal Dharma, which is servant of Krishna. Anything we do can be spiritualized. If we just offer the results to Krishna, it's spiritualized, it's indirectly it becomes Nitya Dharma, and we're situated properly. So if we can distinguish between these things, then we can make very nice progress. So, I was discussing with Warren Prabhu that usually we go to class and we listen, and it's sometimes it's nice and sometimes it's very nice. But what do we get out of it? I mean, when we leave, do we change anything? Or do we just prasadam, haribol. So I would like to invite all of you to come to Sandhya Arati tonight. It's at 6 o'clock. It's half an hour, and it's really nectar. You get to sing for Krishna, and it's the same song every night, and it gets better every time you go, because it's a transcendental activity, so it increases in taste and flavor, and it's really nice. I've made the habit of going, and I think yesterday I counted 3 Western devotees. So I think you should go, because it's really nice, and if there are any questions, I will take them now. Chastisements, corrections. Second approval.
Thank you for the wonderful class.
I think at the bottom there's...
Thank you for the wonderful class, especially the point about Nitya and Naimittic Dharma. I wanted to add something about the Vanaprasthas.
Okay.
There's actually a growing population of Vanaprasthas in our movement who are doing more than just going to the forest and wearing tree bark. A lot of them are traveling and preaching and taking up a lot of important responsibilities in Prabhupada's movement. Some of them are even initiating spiritual masters, like my spiritual master, for example.
I agree totally. The point about going to the forest was only to illustrate that there are no problems with them. We don't have any conflicts. They are doing a wonderful job, and as you say, it's increasingly becoming, people are increasingly, devotees are increasingly becoming aware of this ashram and how much potency is there, especially in terms of guiding the Grihastha ashram, because they've been there, done that, you know, and they can look at it without being emotionally attached to whatever situation is there. So I totally agree, and thank you for bringing that up. They do wonderful work. Thank you. Anyone else? Yes, Anil Prabhu? Can you, the mic? Down? Yes. I think it's going out on the internet, so.
Thank you very much for a wonderful class again.
Thank you.
Is it possible to experience God without being pure?
It's not actually possible to experience anything except God. God is everything. This is, when we say material energy, we're not talking, this can be either material energy or external energy. So experiencing God is about realizing that it's God that you're experiencing, and for that to happen there must be some amount of purity must be there. When the fact is that we are liberated right now, all of us, we just don't realize it. It's like if you're in a jail cell and the cell is not locked, but you think it is, so you don't test the door. So the purity comes from Sukriti, association with the devotees, even if you don't get it. I mean, if the Harinam is going down the street and the biker is standing by the road going, ah, Hare Krishna, he is making advancement. Because the next time he will remember that they actually didn't attack him, or, you know, I mean, and slowly, 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 slowly. So then one day he will actually go to get some free food at the temple, and he will stick around, you know, and suddenly, he might, there are these stories about rowdy people who come to the temple for the Sunday feast and fallen asleep, and the devotees just shaved them up while they were sleeping, and they just stayed. Okay, you know, hey, don't have anything better. So this is a real story from England. So the purity comes in the form of mercy from the devotees. Prabhupada said, I created your good fortune. So some purity must be there, but on the other hand, it's all Krishna. It's just a matter of how much you realize that it is Krishna. Is that okay?
No? Yeah. I think I was referring to the point when you said we go to Mangalarti, we see Krishna there. But the point is, I don't see Krishna actually.
Yes, you do.
I don't feel I see him.
No, so that's something else. You don't feel you see Krishna. I mean, it's not a problem. It means that you want more. So have faith in the process, chant. We get glimpses, right? I mean, there are these glimpses of Bhav, suddenly, you know. I mean, usually it's at the festival or something. The deities, when the curtain is drawn, and they're just really, really beautiful, everybody's there. And I mean, this taste is there. That's seeing Krishna. And just have faith in the process. It is a process. Right? So, okay. Anyone else? Okay. Ethan Nagari, proper.
You mentioned it doesn't matter whether it's pious or impious.
Can I just add a little thing? If the devotion is not there, then it basically doesn't matter.
Yeah, if there's devotion there, and if someone does... I was a little confused there, that's what I'm saying. In other words, can you give an example of somebody who's offered an impiety to Krishna and it's been successful?
We're all doing it. Sadhana bhakti means practice, right? We're practicing. That's why we were saying earlier that do we follow the Vedas or don't we follow the Vedas? And it's both, because we don't follow the Vedas. If you look through Manu Samhita, there are a lot of things in there that we don't follow. Prabhupada gave us very simple instructions because we're all quite messed up in the head. So just follow the four regulative principles, chant your rounds, and have faith in the process, then you'll be okay. So we are actually offering impiety to Krishna. There's the Vedic injunction that every time you go to the bathroom, you have to wash your feet afterwards. I mean, and the way the many bathrooms are designed, the feet washing, if it's there, then it's on the wrong side of the toilet. So you walk straight past and your whole house is contaminated. So we are offering impiety to Krishna. And he's okay with that because he sees the effort. It's like when the four-year-old comes with like a bunch of weird flowers he's picked and it's really ugly and to the mom, and she's very happy because, hey, it's the effort. It's not, but if the husband comes with the same kind of bouquet, he's in the doghouse, right? So we have to see what level are we at. If we do our best, and that's sincerely do our best, if we don't, because the trap is that we say, oh, it doesn't really matter, so I'll just be a nonsense, and then Krishna will see that, hey, I'm devotion. That's the sahaja version. That's the opposite of the smarta. You have the smarta who thinks that if I do everything properly, then Krishna will, abide. And then you have the sahaja on the other side, who just thinks, oh, it's just about the devotion, the emotion, and this. And then they don't really apply themselves in the philosophy, because, hey, who cares? So it's a balance. That's what Vedanta is about, finding the proper balance of everything. Does that make sense? Okay. Janikami Prabhu. Microphone's coming right now.
There's a story about Jayananda who stole some pants. He went to the supermarket or the Walmart, whatever, and he stole some pants. He didn't want to pay for them. He thought, I'm serving Krishna, why should I pay? So he was arrested. He was stopped by the security. Yeah. So that's an impious activity.
Definitely.
But he explained to them, he explained to the authorities who had caught him there, and the police were called in, and so forth. But he explained to them, he said, I work for these people, and they're just so advanced. I don't want to take anything from them, from you I'll take, from whoever I'll steal, but I don't want to take anything from them. And so the security guard was so impressed, that he actually said, I'll pay for them, that's all right. We're not going to charge them.
See?
So like this, his impious activity generated so much bhakti and devotion from even people who were just, completely ugra karma, who were just completely involved with nonsense activity.
Very nice example.
The devotee who told me this story was that he was coming to fetch Jayananda, trying to get him out of jail. And so as he came to the market, the police were coming out. Everybody was laughing and smiling and very happy. So this thing had taken place. So there's a possibility there. Exactly. Not that we're advocating shoplifting.
No, exactly. Okay, thank you very much. Antaraj Srimad Bhagavatam ki, Srila Prabhupada ki. Yeah.